Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and exploitative conditions, and yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. And if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom.
Redemption song. All pirates, yes, they're rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the end of the Almighty. We forward in this generation, triumphantly. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? It's all I ever have. Redemption songs, children. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop the tank. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? It's all I. Redemption songs, redemption songs, sing on with me, children, in every way.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. With me this morning, a WBAI alumnus, Ken Gale, and we're going to talk baseball and genre. But first, something about comics.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, aired on April 10th, 2014. Captain America, The Winter Soldier. Take five. Yes, five. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, that's what we're talking about. Let me say one thing first of all. I'm not deeply steeped in the Marvel Universe, so I'm one of those guys who thought The Winter Soldier referred to Captain America, a.k.a. Steve Rogers himself, not another character who is actually Cap's adversary in this film. Somebody in Marvel Studios marketing needs to learn that the thing to the right of the colon is supposed to modify the thing to the left of the colon. It's not a separate thing. We've got another symbol when you want to put two things together. It's called an ampersand. Or a plus sign if you're Baz Luhrmann, but that's a specialized case. Anyway, let's not get mired in trivialities. Even though that's essentially what we're about to do. What do you want from your superhero movie? Big action? Yep. You want a hero with the powers of a demigod and a moral compass that'll steer him straight and true, and an antagonist powerful enough to be his equal match. And this being the Marvel Universe, you want at least a feint towards deeper themes. Well, congratulations, if you go to Captain America, The Winter Soldier, you'll be getting all that. Or perhaps I should phrase it as, that's all you'll be getting. It's a good film, but a serviceable one, following the roadmap of the Marvel franchises, but not bothering to blaze any trails on its own. Let me point out, I'm not ungrateful for that. You spend enough time watching enough crap. You're grateful when a film gives you 2 hours and 20 minutes of fun, as sibling directors Anthony and Joe Russo deliver here. The original Captain America film, Captain America: The First Avenger, was able to rise above the other Marvel films that were then setting the table for Joss Whedon's The Avengers by being a period piece set during World War II and pitting Cap against his classic foe, the Red Skull. The time period and the conflict gave the film a unique feel, which director Joe Johnston made good use of. Winter Soldier, by comparison, is set in the present day and runs over some well-trod plot elements, with Steve Rogers in flight from his former allies at the secret organization S.H.I.E.L.D. after he's framed for the assassination of an important member of the organization. There are a few surprises and revelations here, although I suppose the more you're familiar with the Marvel Universe, the less likely you are to be surprised by them. Even if you're not one of the true believers, though, so much of the supposed surprises and reversals are part of the stock action film playbook that you won't have much trouble calling the beats way before they crop up. By the way, in addition to Captain America, you're also getting Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow here, and there's good chemistry between her and Chris Evans, who's once again playing Steve Rogers. And Robert Redford is in there and does a good job with his role, and Samuel L. Jackson gets well-deserved screen time returning as Nick Fury, but I know I already had you at Samuel L. Jackson. There are a couple of interesting wrinkles that help elevate this above the off-the-rack action film. I'm not sure if in this we're seeing the guiding hand of Joss Whedon, who's now overseeing the Disney-owned side of the Marvel films. But continuing on from Iron Man 3, Winter Soldier also explores the idea of how fear can be used to manipulate a people, to steer them into the willing surrender of their liberties. Also, fortunately, the film doesn't dismiss Steve Rogers' history, finding ways of bringing his past back, particularly in a beautiful and creepily envisioned scene in an old computer facility that keeps you invested in the fate of these characters. None of this is really integrated into the story as well as it could be, but it goes far enough at least to keep the stakes compelling. By the way, talk about integrating things well. You may notice that in all this talk, I haven't really mentioned the Winter Soldier. You know, the guy on the right side of the colon. Yes, the character who's actually a superpowered assassin, tasked with making life difficult for Cap and his friends, is important in binding Steve to his past and raising our emotional investment in seeing Captain America triumph. But in terms of the scenario, he isn't all that much. He shows up, he blows stuff up and kills people, and he's the big bad for the final throwdown. But his involvement in the plot isn't much more than that. Better than Boba Fett, but ain't no Loki, that's for sure. So there you have it. Captain America the Winter Soldier is a good enough comic book action film, and good enough is good enough if that's what you're looking for. We've got three more Marvel movies coming up this year. If they're all at the level of this, that'll be fine. I can live with that. But I do hope at least one of them exceeds baseline expectations. I've got a potential candidate picked out, but out of respect for all of the films and the people who worked on them, I won't say which. Ball's in your court, Mr. Singer. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Next at the plate for the Yankees, Hank Bauer. On deck, Mickey Mantle.
When we met in 1938, it was November. When I said that I would be his mate, it was December. I reasoned he would be the greatest husband that a girl had ever found. That's what I reasoned. That's what I reasoned. Then April rolled around.
Strike three, ball four, walk around, I'll tie the score. You're blind ump, you must be out of your mind, ump.
6 months out of every year, I might as well be made of stone. 6 months out of every year when I'm with him, I'm alone.
6 months out of every year, he doesn't take me anywhere. 6 months out of every year when I play cards. Solitaire. The other 6 months out of every year, we are hardly ever seen apart. But then the Washington Senators take over my place in his heart. 6 months out of every year, I might as well be wearing crepe. Life is just an awful bore from which I find no escape. 6 months out of every year.
Strike three, ball four, walk around and tie the score. Fly ball, double play, Yankees win again today. Those damn Yankees, why can't we beat them?
Love damn Yankees. Always did. Always will. I actually saw it, a revival of it on Broadway. I saw it twice because I had freebies the second time around. First time I bought tickets. And Charlotte d'Amboise was Lola, the Gwen Verdon role. This is the daughter of the great ballet dancer Jacques d'Amboise, who has worked with Jerome Robbins, and he's still teaching today and doing stuff. But his daughter, who kept getting every rough break in the world, down to including a star in a show, had broken her leg, and d'Amboise was the understudy. She steps up. The word is out during the previews that she's incredible, she's great. And the star of the show came in on opening night. And the critics weren't even there. The critics had seen it, like, you know, the night before opening night and all that. And, you know, apparently the star did a decent job and acquitted herself well, but it was just like the awfulness of her constantly. So anyhow, I saw her in Damn Yankees with Victor Garber as Mr. Applegate and the devil. And then I went back. I was given free tickets 4 or 5 months later, when Victor Garber left the show and Jerry Lewis stepped in. And I thought, oh, my duck. You know, I'm not a Jerry Lewis fan. But he was wonderful. He was an actor. He wasn't being Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
He wasn't. There was one point, and only one point, where in the middle of, in the middle of Mr. Applegate's big song, there's room for a wee bit of improv, and then Lewis, you know, for a minute did his "Hey, lady" kind of thing. But it was only for that moment, and outside of that, he was very good. And apparently, he had decided that reviving Damn Yankees would be like his last big tour. He bought all rights to it, brought it, of course, to France, where Jerry Lewis is more beloved than here. And he ran, and he's going to make a remake of the movie. And Rob Marshall was the director. When you can't get Bob Fosse for reasons like he's dead, you get Rob Marshall. And he...
Zombies are very popular right now.
I'm sorry?
Zombies are very popular right now. You can get Bob Fosse now.
I don't know how any of his wives or mistresses would like that, you know. And there's a lot of them. and some of them still working. But anyway, and Rob Marshall did a great job on the movie Chicago. He's very Fosse-esque without necessarily always imitating Fosse. And he did, but he recreated some Fosse numbers for that Broadway production. And it was a really good production, even with Jerry Lewis. So I guess that says something. At any rate, why baseball? Because it's April.
Right.
And I used to actually do an almost annual show, and Sam Butler, S.C. Butler is the name that he has written a fantasy trilogy for Tor under, a huge baseball fan, a Red Sox fan, was not living in New York by the time the Red Sox finally made it, came into ownership of what they always deserved. Now it's only the Cubs left, I think. They're the only ones who really, like, you know, their turn must come. I think it's over a century now. I think that last time they were won a national tournament was in 1901, thereabouts. It's been over 110 years.
I think it's quite that long, right?
Well, easy enough to look up.
Yes.
But if baseball has anything, it has statistics.
Yes.
But
and you can look it up as a famous line.
You can look it up. And that line was said by?
Is that Yogi or is that Casey?
It's James Thurber.
Oh?
And he probably got it from Damon Runyon. But it was always attributed to Casey, and Casey always said it. You could look it up. No. pardon, I've been getting a cough tonight.
Yeah.
It's not a Yogi-ism. But then again...
Now, Yogi-isms have a different style to them.
Yeah.
It's sort of like hidden wisdom.
Oh, yeah. There's always a certain amount of...
Yeah, it gets late early out there.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and it sounds strange, but you sort of think about it, go, okay, it does make its own kind of sense.
Yeah, and he denies a lot of them.
Yes, I didn't say everything I said.
I think that's exactly
it. Yeah, that's exactly how we put it.
I didn't say everything I said. He probably has writers to make these up because some of them are just too good. But...
No, he doesn't.
There is a huge marriage, as it were, between the science fiction fantasy, not so much the horror, but the science fiction and fantasy genres, and baseball. And there always has been.
Yeah, more so than any of the other sports.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, I would also say that There are better baseball movies than any other sport.
Oh, yeah.
I abhor boxing, and I'm no big fan of football. There was a lot of football cinema in the 30s, you know, all that Rudy Valley rah-rah kind of.
And also, college football popped up in lots and lots of movies as just sort of a subplot.
Absolutely. I mean, even in, which is the Marx Brothers film at the college? Is it Horse Feathers? I think that's the one.
I'm not a big enough Marx Brothers fan to remember which was which.
Shame on you. Anyway, the one that takes place at the college, it's all about building a new football stadium, and there's a football game. And, yeah, that was this whole trope. And I listened to a lot of music from the 20s and 30s, and you can always tell when a football song or football-oriented song is going to come along, and I often tune out. Mm-hmm. At such moments, listen to something different.
I wish we had the George Carlin football baseball thing.
Oh, that's brilliant. I can cue that.
Yeah, because it sums up the difference so well.
It really does.
But most of the versions I've heard don't have any bad words in them.
Hell no. Actually, the way I use the words is they have this. Yeah, and by the way, as I always point out, total disinformation, where it says 7 FCC yes. violations are, in fact, 0 violations in there. The FCC doesn't permit indecency, and that's only during certain hours, which we are out of. But that's
I used to do overnight shows, so I'm aware of that quite well.
Of Safe Harbor, yes.
I did my disclaimer set every night.
Yeah. But what I will do is say, well, you know, number 3, that. I'm sorry, I've got to go out and talk to some number 5 about God knows what, or, you know, something like that. And also, by the way, they've reversed numbers 1 and 2. I think that's Carlin's fault. I think, you know, when he would... you know, when you were in class and you had to raise your hand to be excused to go to the bathroom, you had to hold up finger number 1 or finger number 2, depending on what your needs were. And God knows why teachers were that inquisitive over your extremely personal business. But it's a universal thing, number 1 or 2.
It is universal, or certainly seems to be.
Yeah. And it's reversed. It's reversed in Carlin.
Uh-huh.
Because he just liked the rhythm of the words. But it is WBAI, not even Pacifica, WBAI, who gave them numbers. So I use the numbers. And, you know, the hell isn't on there. The hell with them.
I like when Democracy Now! Played the Carlin routine. You know, and those 7 words are beep, 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 beep.
Oh, we did long before Democracy Now.
Yeah, but I mean...
We did that long before Democracy Now! Existed.
She plays that. Well, anyway.
Yeah, she plays that. Democracy Now! Being pretty much, you know, was created here at WBAI. Mm-hmm. Pardon, just a nasty cough.
I have cough drops. I don't know if you want to have a cough drop while you're trying
too,
to talk.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the problem with that. But going back to movies, there have got to be 2 or 3 Twilight, not movies, but Twilight Zone episodes. The one with a robot pitcher.
Yeah, that's always the first one I think of is Casey.
Casey at the Bat, yeah. But if you go back to early movies... Earlier movies. There's the one with Ray Milland as a chemistry professor called It Happens Every Spring, where he invents, is it a ball that cannot hit wood or wood that cannot hit a ball or something like that? So he becomes a pitcher. And then there was Angels in the Outfield, which was remade as a football movie years later.
It was also remade as a baseball movie.
But was it remade as a baseball
movie? Oh, yeah.
Angels in the Outfield?
Yeah. Oh, it sure was.
Huh. Okay, I'm thinking of it. It was, I mean, it's not long ago, the football one.
I'm not aware of the football one, but there is a baseball remake of Angels in the Outfield.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's quite a few years ago now.
Okay.
It was kind of eh.
Yeah, at any rate, the... or I might actually be confusing Angels in the Outfield with a different baseball picture that got made into a football.
Could be.
Whatever. Whatever.
Because at one point, baseball was the sport in America. Now, football was more the sport in America, so I can see them doing...
No, football was actually more honored by Hollywood and all that in the early days.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as the national pastime, it really was the national pastime, and it was the number one sport in America, boxing being number two, and that has changed over the decades. And certainly,
well, not as far as money is concerned. Baseball still takes in more money because they charge so much.
Football teams are worth more than baseball teams for the most part. Although that just changed this past year. There's a lot more baseball teams on the top list of most valuable sports franchises than there used to be.
Because of cable rights and
all
the different ways they have of monetizing it.
Yep.
And the fact that if you want to pay less than $40 for a ticket anywhere, you're going to a minor league game.
Hmm.
And that's all there is to it, certainly in
New
York.
Like the Mets or something.
It's
a minor league team nowadays. Or
I like the Cyclones, which are part of the Mets as well.
Yes.
But I just got sick and tired of professional sports. But getting back to genre, which is what our conversation is, there were any number of really good baseball movies and in general, and a number of them were genre in one way or another. And then it gets to high-level, high-quality fiction. And there's a lot of great science fiction fantasy.
You consider Field of Dreams a science fiction movie?
Would you not consider it a fantasy
film? I would.
Film?
I'm just wondering if you do.
Well, I would call it a fantasy film. But the novel on which it's based, Shoeless Joe, is without question a fantasy novel in every respect of the word fantasy. It was Kinsella's, W.P. Kinsella's fantasy of meeting with, my poor addled brain, Red Badge of Courage. The author of The Red Badge of Courage.
I don't remember.
Well,
I'm drawing a blank.
Well, it's what the book is about. Shoeless Joe is written by Bill Kinsella, Canadian, W.P. Kinsella, who writes about Ray Kinsella, who goes and kidnaps the author of Red Badge of Courage because he once, in an interview, said it was his favorite sport. And the majority of... And yes, there is the business, if you build it, he will come, and all that. But that's much more of a minor thing in the novel than it is in the movie. Mm-hmm. The novel is mostly these two writers on a road trip in a car, going from one baseball game to another, and finally to Iowa, talking about their fiction. This is not a book that lends itself to cinema. And yet, Phil Alden Robinson did a very, very... I remember his name and not the name of the protagonist of the book, who's real life recluse. He did a brilliant job of getting all the themes of the book into a movie. But, yeah, I mean, of course it's a fantasy film. What is it if not that? Ghosts are playing in the outfield after a godlike voice has spoken.
I'm remembering an argument between two people on one of the sports talk radio shows about one of them saying that it was a baseball movie, the other one saying that it was a science fiction fantasy movie, and they were having a big argument, very passionate.
Uh-huh. And why are these things exclusive?
Well, yeah, that's my point also, yes. I love combinations of things.
But anyhow, Kinsella has written two great science fiction, and by science fiction I mean all-encompassing, including fantasy novels. The other one is The Great Iowa Baseball Confederacy, which is a book about a ball game that has been going on for 75 or 80 years. Hmm. And it's just being played over and over again by, I think, basically a group of Indians who were largely responsible for many aspects of the original game. And it's been too long since I've read it. But
well, the history of baseball goes back to ancient Egypt. I mean, it's...
That's debatable.
No. Well, I mean, you can define it. So, but if you define baseball or the roots of baseball, the origins of baseball, as a ball that is thrown, a bat that hits the ball, and then you run to more than two bases, I would define that as baseball. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball, you run bases. They're saying the origins of cricket are two bases, and the origin of baseball more than two bases. And you have games like that in ancient Egypt. The bases were on a pole that you touch with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of bases were different in different parts of the world.
And how do we know this, by the way? Explain that. Was there a rule book?
Because there's all kinds of drawings of it and mentions of it. And then there were various ball games like that played in medieval times with as many as nine bases. There are mentions of, in a newspaper in 1792 in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, about you're forbidden to play baseball near the new courthouse because they didn't want the windows broken. And so clearly baseball had been played before 1792.
Yeah, but they didn't call it that.
Yeah, no, it was baseball, not baseball. And then in different parts of England, it was called town ball, and there were various names for it. There's another name in New England that's just one word. It doesn't have base or ball in it. And that was the word used by some of the people who played baseball with George Washington at Valley Forge. We have letters from the soldiers talking about him playing ball with them and how happy they were that George Washington would deign to play baseball with them during off times. There's a lot of baseball that happened before 1845.
But modern baseball is created in 1845.
Yes, and one of the big differences...
And what it is that a rule book was written.
And foul territory was defined very, very rigidly.
Yes.
There was a time where baseball didn't have foul, and the fielders were all over the place. So you had fielders behind the batter in all different directions, as well as in front of the batter, all different numbers of people.
But getting back to genre, is why we are here.
I love baseball comic books stories.
Okay.
There's lots of those.
Well, I was in the middle of discussing books.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to name a few more.
I'm sure written.
Obviously, one of the best of all is The Natural by Bernard Malamud,
mm-hmm.
which is a... and one should not compare the novel to the movie. As decent as the movie is, the movie pretty much takes all of the mysticism out of it. It makes stuff symbolic. But the novel is without question... a parody of Der Ring des Nibelungen, and down to including the how Roy, I'm trying to remember the character's last name, Roy Hobbs, how he gets his bat by the lightning striking the tree, which is not dissimilar to how Siegfried gets Nothung, mm-hmm. and... And, of course, the end of the novel, The Natural, is, like Siegfried, he fails. He does not hit the home run. In fact, the whole point is heroes must fail. And that's very much a part of the book, that mythic, tragic heroes are just that. They are tragic. And this guy is paying for sins that he has committed.
Right, Mighty Casey did strike out.
Mighty Casey did strike out, and Roy Hobbs does not hit a home run in that book. And it's a great, great
But American
novel.
Movies can't do that.
Yeah, basically. And it's a shame because the movie captures the feel of a good baseball movie so well. But what it does not do is it does not capture Bernard Malamud. And I always assumed that it was the director was overridden by the studio or something like that, but then I read in an interview that, no, this was the director's decision, and I felt betrayed.
I understand The Natural is the most watched baseball movie by baseball players, and with Major League being number two.
Very probably true. One of the best bona fide science fiction novels that are baseball is Brittle Innings by Michael Bishop. And it is a twisted, wonderful book. It is not long before we realize that the scout, who is the lead character in the book, is old. As in old, actually, I think dating back to about 1817, and I can't discuss it without revealing a major reveal, which is actually what Michael Bishop calls it. I have stopped using the word spoiler because people say, oh, yeah, spoilers. What are you talking about spoils? It doesn't spoil this or that to describe. Well, number one, no, it doesn't necessarily spoil things, but it does take pleasure away.
Right.
And the term that Michael Bishop used when I interviewed him in relation to this novel is there is a reveal that will take away a certain amount of pleasure of the reader if that reveal is given away too early. It's about a third of the way through the book. And I can't say anything more about it without revealing.
I avoid movie trailers because they reveal things that I just
Some movie
know.
Trailers do that. They give away right. the entire thing.
And you don't know whether the movie trailer you're about to see is one of those movie trailers until you see it, so I just avoid them.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I actually like the recent tendency of certain movie trailers just to show, like, a 5-minute clip from the movie. And not even an explanation of, you either know what it is, if it's part of great American culture. They did that with Star Trek Into Darkness, and I thought the trailer was better than the film. But there wasn't a single edit or anything in there. They simply showed a sequence that took place early in the film where Spock is walking along a volcano planet. And it really has very little to do with the movie itself. But it was a lot of fun to just see that. And it certainly would help sell the movie. Without giving you all kinds of instances of what the film is about.
Yeah. Instances out of order and, yeah.
And original trailers are very good. Aardman Films know how to do them very, very well. There's a trailer for a movie not coming out till next year, Shaun the Sheep movie. And the trailer can be found on YouTube. And it's a trailer, you know. In other words, it talks to the audience knowing it's a trailer. And recent Muppet films have been brilliant with their trailers and so forth. And actually, a lot of the stuff coming out from Disney animation under the sight of John Lasseter, who is the head of Disney animation after having been the head of Pixar. He's now in charge of all Disney animation, including the 2D stuff, the mm-hmm. hand-drawn slash computerized material, rather than the computerized material. Well, RenderMan. Pixar stuff uses RenderMan software, which used to run on Pixar computers. That's what the name is. They built their own computer. It was called Pixar. And the animations were rendered on Pixar computers. That's how they got their name. But the software they use is RenderMan software. And it's actually, they've given it to the world, which is actually one of the reasons why there's a lot of animated movies coming out of smaller studios now. They can afford to use the same tools that the big boys play with. That's
good for them.
Yeah. Although I must say, by the way, the best animated film I have seen in a long, long time is Ernest and the Celestine, which was an Academy Award nominee last year, but nobody has seen it because it's a French film.
Uh-huh.
And it only opened in the U.S. officially in a dubbed version. I saw it in the French version. In the dubbed version about 3 weeks ago. It was at the IFC Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's even there anymore, but no doubt it'll be available on cable or something like that. And it is the single most charming, fun animated.
What's it called again?
Ernest and Celestine.
Ernest and Celestine.
Yes.
Okay.
Ernest is a bear and Celestine is a mouse. Oh. And they each live in different societies. She lives in a very Dickensian society, and he in sort of a 1984 kind of. They're both dystopic. And and they end up setting up house and stuff. It's a minimalist animation, just hand-drawn. And my favorite animated film outside of WALL-E, which is in a whole different class of cinema, you know, big, expensive Pixar film, than Triplets of Belleville was the last animated film that I really loved. Coincidentally, again, French. So anyhow, and there's one other novel, which is a baseball novel. It's called The Great American Novel by Philip Roth, and that is also a science fiction baseball book. And then there's just tons of short stories. There are two or three anthologies of nothing but science fiction baseball short stories. And
are they still in print, any of them?
No.
No, the figures.
No, these are from, I mean, the most recent one I can think of is the late 70s. When anthologies were very commonplace. You don't see those anymore.
No, you don't. What happened?
The short stories don't make money. Hmm. It's very simple. The market has changed somewhat thanks to the e-book, because it costs the same to produce a short story as it does to produce a novel. Almost the same. And since Amazon has made a market out of selling individual stories that people can download or sometimes give some away for free and things like that, the short story is making a bit of a comeback. And as well, there are new venues. There are only three science fiction magazines left. There's Asimov's Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction and Analog Magazine. There's also Space and Time Magazine and other very fine, but closer to semi-prozines than prozines that come out. And Space and Time, for example, is considered a semi-prozine. Right? Very high quality in publishing standards and all that, and they pay the minimum that Science Fiction Writers of America demands, which is 6 cents a word, just went up to 6 cents a word from 5 cents a word. And but the online market with magazines like Clark's World and Lightspeed Magazine, for whom I work on their podcasts, and I feel compelled to always say that, but, you know, let's put it this way. I'm not being paid by them a whole lot more than I am at WBAI, and I'm an unpaid staffer here at WBAI,
yeah, right.
But it's a pleasure to be associated with Lightspeed Magazine. Three Nebula nominations so far.
Oh, good for them.
Well, not so far. Three Nebula nominations. In fact, the Nebulas, we're closing in on them, but they're being held in San Jose, so there's no way in San Jose that I'm going to be able to get there. They usually do like 2-year contracts with hotels. So for 2 years it was in Washington, and those I went to, and now for last year and this year it's in San Jose, and I don't know where it is next year, but if I can, I'll go there. I always get great interviews at the Nebulas.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Pardon me. So now segueing from movies and novels and short stories with baseball and science fiction, why don't we discuss comic books?
Yeah.
You yourself have committed this act.
Yes, I did. My very first published fiction was a fantasy baseball story, Sword and Sorcery in Baseball. Most of it taking place in 1978, which is when it was written, and some of it taking place in the a nebulous distant past, when magic was commonplace. And
everybody wore sandals.
And, yeah. And, you know, people fought with edged weapons and whatnot. And the reason that I wrote it is because Warren Publishing was publishing science fiction and fantasy sports stories. And I started a softball team of comic book fans back in 1975. And we played against Marvel, and we played against Continuity Associates, and we played against Warren.
Never played against WBAI.
No.
We did have a team.
Yeah, I think the team came. Well, I don't know if it came after that or not.
I think our team came after.
My team was 75, 76, and 77.
Yeah, I think, let's see. No, we were already out of the church. Or were we?
Well, I know there was, when I first came to BAI in 91, there was a team, and it lasted maybe one more year. And that's considerably after 77. But my whole sort of thought process was I wanted to write a baseball science fiction or fantasy story. And I had a friend who was an editor at Warren, and I'm figuring, well, I played against them in baseball or softball, and if I did not sell the story, at least I could say, you know, ask for advice, and he can go, write what you know. Okay, Ken, you know, and it would break the ice, and then he could give me whatever advice I needed. And I sold the story right away. I brought my plot there, and the editor bought it.
So you couldn't get advice.
And I never got advice, and I sometimes wonder, would I have been able to sell a sequel if I had that extra person sort of in my corner, you know, to help me sell things? But because I was writing plot notes for the sequel during the one-game play-in between the Red Sox and the Yankees in 78. So I was in, I was actually at a convention that weekend, and the game was on. And so everybody's watching the game, and I'm taking notes. You know, every time I would think of an idea while watching the game, oh, I should put that in. Oh, I have to put that in. But I never sold the sequel.
I would have been at that game because I was at every home team game, Mets or Yankees, in 1978.
Oh.
Right up until
wasn't
playoffs.
That game played in Boston?
Oh, so that I don't know.
I think it was played in Boston.
All I know is that it was a New York versus Red Sox game.
Yes.
In New York, I was there.
Yeah, I think there was like a coin toss and Boston won, and they And I got to be the home team.
And I got, and in order to facilitate this, I did a BAI show called Left Field.
And that was you.
That was me. And I created that show for the sheer reason that I wanted to be press at ball games and get into games for free. So I created that show and traded tapes with Danny Schechter, who has been on BAI's air very recently for his book about Mandela, but was at the time at WBCN in Boston, doing a lot of baseball material. Danny Schechter News Dissector. And that's the name he still uses. Mm. And he does sort of a progressive blog nowadays. And but he and I traded some tapes, and he got me interviews with Bill Lee, who was my favorite Red Sox. Yeah. One sock, two socks, right?
So He was
called the Spaceman.
He was a lot of fun. He was great in the Ken Burns baseball special.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's basically just your standard progressive hippie, which people don't expect baseball people to be.
Yeah.
To be a progressive activist.
Yeah, in the late 60s, that was a little more common. Nowadays, it's very rare.
In baseball?
Yeah.
Like whom?
A lot of the 69 Mets were progressive.
Outspoken.
There was a lot of, outspoken about the Vietnam War, about civil rights.
Well, when interviewed and asked questions. I mean, Tom Seaver was what Margot describes as a Ford Republican.
And there's one of the 69 Mets is still somewhat active in progressive causes. Pops up now and then. He lives on Long Island.
That being?
I can't remember his name now.
Okay.
Too bad. I was really into that team.
I lived with about three quarters of a mile from Shea.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to many games that year. But I followed that team.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was both a Yankee and a Met fan. And, of course, a lot of kids I went to school with were like, you can't be a fan of both. And I'm like, why not? They're both local teams. Why not? And
well, that goes back to the Dodgers, basically. And it was weird enough with the Giants and the Dodgers being in the same league, and at least they got to play each other all the time. But when the Yankees would constantly beat the Dodgers until one fateful year,
right?
When the Dodgers finally won, it was either or. And if you were from Brooklyn or Queens, you were a Dodgers fan. And if you were from Manhattan, you were a Yankee fan. That's all there is to it. And all the Brooklyn Dodgers, they may have come from different places around the country, but 6 months out of every year, they lived in Brooklyn, and most of them. Not in Flatbush, where the stadium was, but in the Bay Ridge area, Fort Hamilton, if you prefer, and Gil Hodges, Duke Snider, Pee Wee Reese, not Jackie Robinson. He lived in Flatbush, but when they were on the road, Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson were roomies, but not necessarily in Brooklyn. At least not that anybody's willing to admit to. And since I know, well, you can laugh, but
yeah,
it's where I live.
Yeah.
On the street where I live. So I know the owners of the house that Pee Wee Reese lived in. And they would not be willing to say that there was a black person living in this very red state part.
Yeah, right.
Of Brooklyn, for the most part. So, but it's very simple. you really can't be a fan of both. And they are also so antithetical to each other, the Mets and the Yankees. The Mets really were the wild and woolly losers and, you know, let's play another game against the Cubs, the old Ernie Banks, let's play two thing.
Play two.
And the Mets, of whom Jimmy Breslin wrote the book, Can't Anybody Here Play This Game, were the antithesis of the Yankees that were always corporate until they weren't corporate anymore and owned by a man who was a felon in the after the Watergate
yeah,
hearings.
Right.
Something I've never understood is how Pete Rose can be thrown out of baseball for betting on his own team, but a man who was convicted of a felony perjury regarding B.B. Rebozo is allowed to own a team.
Well, I think it's a follow the money situation.
Yeah. As it always
among many other things.
With the commissioner of baseball being an employee of the owners.
Right.
You know, going way back to Kennesaw Mountain Landis, to the very first commissioner of baseball.
Yep.
So, yeah. And the only one who seemed to be an exception was his first name Paul Giamatti Sr., the actor's father, who's a poet, who was a commissioner of baseball.
Yeah.
And he was not in anybody's... he wasn't anybody's best friend, so he didn't last long in the job.
Yeah.
He didn't like them. Yeah. They didn't care for him that much either. So, what other comics?
There was a series of five issues of Brave and Bold in 1965 called Strange Sports Stories. And they would combine all different sports with different types of science fiction and fantasy elements. And there was one of a headless baseball team. There's another of a gorilla baseball team. Most of the stories were written by John Broome, who's one of my favorite all-time writers. And it was that inspired me to want to do a sports story when I saw that somebody was publishing them in comics forms. And they tried to revive Strange Sports Stories in the 70s, but the writing was just so inferior. Everything just seemed so forced. The science fiction elements were forced. The sports elements were forced. They were written by people who were not into sports and would say so. And it was obvious. You know, they had no details about the games, and even if they were made-up games, the details were missing. Whereas when John Broome was writing them, the details were just absolutely wonderful. And then, of course, they would combine different types of sports in a weightless setting to set it in the future. And there's some neat stuff there where they had a little combination
careful of the tape and making huge noises on the air.
Making a big difference, like combining basketball and football in a weightless situation to make a brand new sport they would call Spaceball. I think Spaceball popped up in a lot of stories.
Uh-huh. Not surprised.
And John Broome would introduce Spaceball when he was writing Green Lantern. You had Hal Jordan going to a Yankee game, except they weren't the Yankees, and it wasn't really Roger Maris, but obviously it was Roger Maris that he was talking about.
Uh-huh.
He just switched the letters around. But it's interesting that back then sports popped up in comics a lot more than it does now. And I suspect it's just the makeup of the writers an awful lot of comic book writers are just not into any sports at all.
Uh-huh.
So it's not going to pop up.
That means going outside and exercising.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. And there's also this sort of intellectual versus jock thing that you grew up with in high school. And I would imagine it must have been around in the 30s and 40s when those people grew up. But I don't know why it didn't manifest itself in the same way.
Yeah.
Because I sure remember the jocks versus people with good grades thing that when I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
you weren't allowed to be both, and people would not accept. I was a good athlete, but I got good grades.
Uh huh.
And people just would not accept the fact that I could be a good athlete.
And it would always be the jocks who would get the scholarships, because so much money is dependent to schools for their sports.
Yeah, that's certainly, and having just gone through March Madness, where it's all about college and sports, you'd think that there wasn't anything else going on in any college in the country.
Yeah, I always thought March Madness was about technology sales, but, which shows how much attention I pay.
Yeah, to me, it's about gambling, so I could never get into it.
How so?
Oh, office pools.
I see.
Yeah, office. They're the only.
That's not gambling.
The only sports betting. The only time that there's more betting going on about sports than March Madness is the Super Bowl.
Okay, but meaningless to me.
And
gambling is Atlantic City and Las Vegas. That's gambling.
Well, Evan Roberts made a great.
And they have sporting book rooms.
Yeah.
In every major hotel in Las Vegas. Mm. I've never been to Atlantic City, except to conduct an interview.
He made a great observation, although he didn't. I think he stopped before he went all the way. Whenever Roberts said that it's in most with most sports, as you go through the playoffs, people get more interested when you get to the final rounds. But with March Madness, people get less interested because their office pool no longer has the teams in it, so they don't care.
If they can't win
their office pool, then they don't care about
the
playoffs.
What sports are affiliated with March Madness?
Basketball, college basketball.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And there's 68 teams or whatever it is that are the final teams, and they whittle it down to the So there's an actual playoff system in college basketball, unlike college football. But people are not as interested in who wins as they are in whether their office pool sheet is doing well or not.
Okay. But
and there's a lot of money being made and lost. Gambling on which teams are going to be in the final four and the final eight and 16 and everything.
Yeah. Don't do that as much for tennis, huh?
No, not that I know of.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some.
Oh, there's gambling and everything. I mean, they can, people gamble over whether a movie star is going to be divorced in a month or a year or whatever.
Well, that's a sure thing. You don't have to gamble over that.
Well, the amount of time is what you gamble over.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah, you can always pool on.
Yeah. You can gamble over everything.
Like yeah. Yeah, but office pools, they really don't count for a whole lot. That's not what I think. I have seen people gamble, and I mean go to Las Vegas and never having sat down at a table before or at a slot machine and be unable to get up because they are taken. That's gambling.
Yeah, yeah.
So when somebody says, office pool, it's like, oh, come on. That's not it.
When I was hitchhiking across the country, I got picked up by a guy in a Cadillac from Las Vegas. And he had trouble not using the word system in a sentence. It popped up in almost everything he said. And he talked about his system for having gotten the car that I was in at the time. And he would basically be on a certain spot in Las Vegas where people who had lost everything would sell their car in order to get home.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't quite understand. If you've got a car, isn't that how you get home?
No, but you still have to buy gas.
Yeah.
That's going to cost as much or more than a train ticket.
So he would buy cars really, really, really cheap. And so he always had a relatively new Cadillac.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about his system for, meeting women and traveling down the road and eating. And, I mean, it was amazing. He had a system for everything.
Well, I was a system administrator. So... has a very different meaning for me.
Well, back then, I don't think computers had been invented yet. It was right before the woolly mammoth became extinct.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, that was when I was hitchhiking cross country.
I never used a woolly mammoth. I used a weird operating system. There's that word again, yes.
Right.
For that. If you would like to call and discuss science fiction, fantasy, comics, genre, and baseball specifically, the telephone number here is 212-209-2900. And, oh, and at some point I have to tell people how wonderfully last Monday's Robert Sheckley tribute went. But
yeah.
Yeah, which I'm sorry you missed. We had some major, major comic book royalty there.
Yeah, I was at a really, really good meeting, environmental meeting.
Yeah.
By incredible, wonderful people, and I'm glad I didn't miss it. Even though I am
this was a once
happy
in a
that I missed yours.
As,
yeah.
As opposed to the... as opposed to the monthly event. But anyway, good morning. You're on the radio.
Hey.
Hello.
I'd like to talk about all that stuff. Did you, I think you left out Rhubarb.
Thank you. Thank you.
Preston Sturges' last movie, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't recall if he actually wrote that film or what. I remember the novel by H. Allen Smith.
But I think there was supposedly a real Rhubarb at which stadium it was.
No. I mean, Rhubarb was a comedy novel in the 30s by H. Allen Smith.
But there was a cat that lived at the stadium. According to my mother, she said there was a real cat, and it was written up somewhere, and that's where the story came from.
Ah, well, H. Allen Smith was simply a very prolific humorist, and that novel was, as I recall, published in Mercury magazine over a course of several issues. And I remember all this because I read Rhubarb over and over again as a very young person because I lived where the novel took place, which is Jackson Heights, which at that time was still called Jackson Heights, Long Island, before it became Jackson Heights, Queens. and when I was growing up, it was still... You would address your envelope, Jackson Heights, Long Island.
Can I comment on the Captain America thingy or the Marvel Comics?
No spoilers.
In a moment, I was just going to finish the story of Rhubarb and the Jackson Heights Country Club, which is a place I went to any number of times, and that is where the novel begins taking place. I'm sure there have been cats that lived in baseball stadiums.
Oh, yeah. Many.
Many, and intentionally so. Okay, so about Captain America.
I haven't seen the movie yet, so I can't really comment on it, but I did see the second Thor movie, which I thought was good.
Tom Hiddleston.
Oh, he's very good, and I was, like, noticing him in the first movie going, like, I didn't really like the first Thor movie, but... this guy Loki is like, he's really acting up a storm in this. You know,
well,
he kind of reminds me of, and I noticed in the second movie.
He is one of the leading Shakespearean actors in the world.
Well, I was going to mention that he sits up in a certain thing, and I said, like, this guy reminds me of Gary Oldman a little bit. Like, you know, the same kind of, like, understated, like credibility or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you should see The Hollow Crown, which was a BBC. They did four out of the eight plays of. I'm sorry?
Unless you send it to me, how am I ever going to see it?
There's something called PBS.
Yeah, well, okay. You know what happened to the TV?
Don't know.
Well, I mean, like.
Not quite
like
relevant
the last
to.
5 years or something like that?
I'm sorry?
You think, like, you think everybody has cable and all that?
Yes, I do. And even if they don't have cable, they can watch it on the internet, which is where I saw it first. People do have access to screens, and I think, yes, everybody has it.
So can I say hi to Ken?
You just did.
Well, hi. I actually spoke to you in face-to-face, like on the street, like so many times. So I'm just on the phone now.
Well, hi.
Yeah. Remember I told you about what I thought about the Bond movie? Before you got on the bus? That was like when my first comment on the new James Bond.
I actually do not remember.
I think we are really reaching off topic here.
I know. The last James Bond movie cured me of, like, James Bond-itis, like, forever. I just, like, completely thought it was, like, ugh. And I love Xavier Vadim. He's, like, excellent. And if you'd see a movie called Dance with the Devil with him and Rosie Perez and Screaming Jay Hawkins, it's, like, it's so crazy.
Okay, but we are really getting off topic here.
Off topic. Captain America. Here's the thing. The character, I don't want to give away spoilers without mentioning what I want to say either, but it's just like there's so many characters that I was like mentioning with this guy, actually at the library that's like loves Marvel Comics, that when the characters supposedly die and then come back, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, that happened in the Avengers.
Marvel Comics was always kind of good at that, where it's like, I mean, like characters did come back in ridiculous ways. And then you, like, get real frustrated. It's like, well, this isn't, like, you know, how it's supposed to be. And then I just realized, like, you know, you got to relax, like, you know, going, like, these characters don't even exist. Why am I getting so upset? And they're dying. They're coming back to life. Why they don't even? Yeah, it's like, you know, a multiverse or whatever ridiculous kind of,
well, that is the entire
throw into kind of, you know,
that is the premise of the entire TV show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you understand, right?
I'm sorry?
Okay, since you don't have a TV, you wouldn't know, but there's this TV show called Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is all about how a character who's killed in the Avengers movie is the lead character in this TV series.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire plot running through it is about how is it possible that this guy was dead for days.
Hmm.
Oh, this is done after he gets killed? He's
yes.
Supposedly still alive? I would guess it was LMD. Life model decoy.
Okay, well, the point is,
I was watching.
I think we're so way off topic that we should move along, unless you have something.
Well, I was just thinking, like you know, these characters that just come. It's just like they can't create new characters; they have to kind of revamp the old ones.
Well, there is a reason for that. It's called work for hire. If a person creates a new character for Marvel, Disney owns it. The writer does not, and so an awful lot of creators are very hesitant to create anything new because they figure, I'll work for Marvel, get a big enough name, and then I can create characters of my own that I will own, and do that using that name. So
and can in turn sell those to movies.
Yes. So people are using Marvel as a jump off to go into independent comics rather than what used to be the other way around.
Yeah, but some guys just do like a couple of comics and like I guess an example, I was thinking Jim Steranko, who's still around, but I haven't seen a lot of his stuff lately. You know,
his output is minuscule. I mean,
yeah,
he's probably got the smallest output for the most fame of any artist.
Yeah, although he had an interesting article yesterday in the
Shield,
Hollywood Reporter.
The best thing going, you know, in the Steranko land. Anyway, just very, very, I don't know. Just what was that comics documentary that just came out? Did you see that one?
I've seen several recent ones.
Well, there's one, like a recent one. It was a three-hour PBS one.
I saw
very
that.
Very amazing, and you know they were like.
I thought the first two parts were very good, and then the third part was nothing but an infomercial.
So you're Golden Age rather than Silver Age?
I'm neither. I'm not a comics person.
I know.
I'm talking about the talking about the quality of the documentary.
It depends on who wrote it.
Can I make a forensic question?
I mean, I'm a big Bill Finger fan from the Golden Age, big John Boom fan from the Silver Age.
Like I'm kind of doing a forensic search on my own and trying to figure out what was the first superhero, and if like you consider like the 20th century phenomenon, sometimes in the 30s, was it the Shadow? Was it I mean, these are the most ones that we remember. But there's something that like is actually, I guess, coined as the actual first one.
That would be something called Superman.
Well, that depends on how you want to define
well,
it.
Well, with superpowers.
If it's superpowers and a costume, the Phantom Detective from the early 30s, I forgot which comic strip that was in.
Which superpowers did he have?
What was it? Strength and flight? I forgot now.
What about the Shadow?
Shadow has no superpowers. He can cloud the minds of men.
Yeah, I mean,
Well, hey, that's very vague.
And I like what Nelson Bidwell's answer to that in a letter page was the first superhero was, you know, told around a campfire in caveman days, a person who could run faster than a deer and was stronger than a bear. I mean, you know.
But those are supernatural powers, not superheroes.
Yeah, but the point is, it's how you first have to define what a superhero is.
20th century.
And you can spend an hour just defining it.
Phenomenon, because there were all sorts of, like, different mediums, but there weren't, like, comic book mediums until the 20th century, if I assume.
No, I believe there were comics, four-panel comics and the like before that.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the 20th century.
Well, I mean, now you're talking about the technology of printing.
I'm defining it sometimes in the 30s. Was there anything like around then or before then? It's kind of vague. It's kind of like very...
Well,
I mean, there were characters of powers and abilities that were written in the 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. And in prose as well. But if you're talking about the comic book superhero, with the classic concept of a hero, B, actual superpowers as opposed to simply an unnatural ability, I don't think you will find anybody who will gainsay that it's Superman.
Well, that's the usual, but then people...
Including that PBS documentary.
Pre-Golden Age, Dr. Alcott from DC, and he had supernatural powers, are those superpowers because they're supernatural powers or what?
Do you define a superhero as like having superpowers?
Well, the word super, well,
yeah, see, that's the whole point. You can spend an hour defining it.
Not really, because there are too many people, documentarians and people who talk about this, as you know, people like Danny Fingeroth and all that.
Doctor Who is a superhero?
I'm sorry?
Would you consider Doctor Who a superhero?
No.
Well, I would tell you why I would think so, because... Like the Green Hornet, I would consider a superhero because the Green Hornet has what? A mask, a secret identity, and gadgets that no other person has. In that retrospect, Doctor Who is the same kind of character.
He is, but I'm not sure that I would define the Green Hornet as a superhero.
Let me finish. He's defined. He predates.
Well, let me finish, okay?
As a man of mystery, right? And then he also has.
The original name for superheroes were mystery men before the term superhero was invented.
That's right. That's right.
The Judex movie was like inspired Batman, and that was like a jewel thief, and basically it was like a masquerade where everyone was wearing like animal masks. If you ever saw it,
I'm sorry, which film?
Version and a 1960s one. I've seen them both.
Which film?
I think it's called Judex. I'm pronouncing it wrong. My French is like so. So Bowie boys, I forget about it. J-U-D-E-X.
Okay.
French movie.
Okay.
And I think the guy that created Batman, whether it was Kane or Fingerman, was inspired by that scene where it's literally like a, everyone's dressed as like animal masks in like high society Paris.
Okay, but we have gone from baseball and genre.
Yeah.
Into some nether world.
And we only have a few minutes left of the show.
Yeah, okay. And by the way, rhubarb isn't science fiction or fantasy.
But it's a cat that like owns the Yankees.
He is willed Yankees. He doesn't have a will. He's nothing but an ordinary, plain cat.
It's a weird movie. It's not as good as...
And it's a novel. It's a novel. It's a novel. H. Allen Smith wrote there. Later on, a movie was made starring Ray Milland. Yes, but it was a very, very famous novel and a not so famous movie.
Well, it's not the best. Preston Sturges. The other ones are better. Okay. Good night, guys.
Okay.
Good night.
And good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Okay. How are you?
All right. I'd love to talk baseball, but I thought maybe I could help clarify something, in my opinion, as far as superhero and supernatural. I think if you have any type of super ability, whether it's classified as supernatural or superhuman, and you use it for good, and you're classified as a superhero, if you use it for bad, you are classified as a villain.
I think that's fair.
Is that do you define Batman as a superhero with that definition?
Yes.
Because he has no superpowers. not supernatural.
I mean, that's
nor...
always the bugaboo is people who say, oh, Batman's not a superhero. Yes, he is a superhero.
He came out of, what was the name of the book?
Detective Comics.
Yeah.
He could do things that a normal person could not do. You know, you or I could not magically make a rope come out of, you know, a piece of garment that we're wearing and swing from, you know, one building to another, et cetera, et cetera.
No, well, Spider-Man, so, not Batman, but
Batman does that sort of thing. I mean, I know where you're coming from.
I watched Adam West do it many times.
And, okay.
Climb up the side of a building. You know, no one could. You know, we can't do that.
But I mean, I define it because he does things that the average person can't do, so that makes him a superhero, and so I look at him that way. But I understand the people who don't, because he doesn't have superpowers. He doesn't do things that you can't do. He does things that a little bit what we can do, but better.
Yeah, and if you watch the different interpretations of the Batman through the years, he's played very differently every time.
Yeah.
The Christopher Nolan Batman definitely does not have superpowers. Neither does the Michael Keaton one, come to think of it.
Again, it's you know, definition
I don't believe he was that way in the original comics.
Batman has been around for 75 years,
yes,
so
and
he's had so many different writers and artists, and they've done so many different things.
But I dare
him.
Say that the Bob Kane definition is the original.
Yeah, but if you think about it,
well, Bob Kane hardly did
Batman,
anything to do with Batman.
Oh, that's right.
Batman could do, guys. You know, back in the 60s, when Adam West would not excite today's comic reader or today's action hero or superhero.
Well, today's...
I was alive then, and he didn't excite me. I was insulted.
Today's stuff is humorless, and that's my big problem with almost all of the genre films. I just finally saw Man of Steel last night, as a matter of fact, and like the other Christopher Nolan run movies, they're devoid of humor. That's at least one thing that the Marvel movies have. They're funny. They're intentionally funny.
And I wonder if the Batman TV show is an influence on being humorless when you're doing Batman and Superman.
No, because Tim Burton did very funny Batman movies.
Yeah, would you call those funny?
Oh, God, are you kidding?
I just not remembering because I didn't like him.
Starting with Michael Keaton, casting Michael Keaton
as the
Batman and the comic turns that he does. It's a comedy, and Tim Burton would call it a comedy. And so, you know, it's a comedy. That's what made them so enjoyable. With character actors like Fred Gwynn and Jack Palance and Jack Nicholson leaving no piece of scenery unchewed.
Yeah,
these are comedies.
Was there specific topics that you guys wanted to talk about?
Well, I'm afraid...
Baseball!
Baseball, but we are out of time.
All right. Well, you guys have a great night then.
Okay,
all right, thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. I didn't realize it until you said so, Ken, but I turned around and, in theory, my theme, my outro theme is supposed to begin in about 45 seconds.
Yeah, well, the way the studio is set up, if we're looking at each other, I see the clock and you don't.
Yes, exactly. Unfortunately, what I also don't see is Lister, my replacement, and I cannot hang out indefinitely here. So I will have to...
Yeah, he's usually kind of early, isn't he?
He usually is, but he's often also late because the subways don't...
Yeah, subways are a mess, aren't they?
Especially getting this far uptown. So I'm going to have to figure out something to be putting on the air. And I'm sure that I will find something suitable. And actually, you know this system here probably better than I do. So you can help.
If it's been rewired, I don't know the system at all.
No, it's a question of finding a show. It's not a question of rewiring something.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah,
at
maybe
any
I can.
Rate, I figured as much. So let me...
Movie review.
Whoops. Oh, now how's that playing again? I thought I was playing
my outro music, and I'm going to have to skip ahead.
Well, actually, this system does replay things without you telling it to.
A little bit. There we go. And I do want to thank everybody who came by to the Robert Checkley tribute, and especially Elisa Quitney, speaking of comics. She was at Vertigo for any number of years. And as I mentioned, we had a bit we had two Vertigo editors there, as a matter of fact, and some other comics royalty. But we'll talk about that some other time, especially because Elisa Quitney is going to be on the show soon enough. Next week, I'm not sure what we shall be doing, but we'll be doing something. And until then, you can visit the Facebook page for Hour of the Wolf. And don't forget to visit the Echologic page, where Ken has finally, finally made an appearance, and hell hath not totally frozen over, just partially.
Yes. Jim Freund has been trying to push me onto Facebook for quite a while, and then finally
Kim
Frashik dragged
promotion.
Me in.
Just for the purpose of promotion.
Yeah, no, I certainly understand that. I got an epiphany today.
So anyhow, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next Wednesday night, Thursday morning at 1:30 a.m. And until then...
And I'm Ken Gale.
Until then, he's Ken Gale. Take care. And while we're waiting for the computer to work, this is WBAI New York City.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we celebrate the life and work of the late, great Lena Horne by presenting recordings Miss Horne did with Pacifica Radio. Lena Horne was born on June 30th, 1917, and died on May 9th, 2010. We'll hear Lena herself talk about her youth and her early years at the Cotton Club and Cafe Society. But what's important to know about her for this hour is how it came to be that we have this extraordinary woman on tape in the archives. It has almost everything to do with her life as an activist and a champion of civil rights. Lena Horne's Hollywood career was essentially done by the mid-1950s, due to blacklisting because of her political views. She was a close personal friend of fellow blacklisted superstar Paul Robeson and very active in the civil rights movement. It was here at Pacifica that Lena Horne, like Paul Robeson, found a home. In 1966, Pacifica station KPFA producer Gene D'Alessi sat down with one of the great talents of our time for an amazingly candid interview. Here's Gene introducing Lena Horne.
Pacifica Radio in Berkeley brings you Lena.
Don't know why. There's no sun up in the sky, so together.
Lena, a sound portrait of a multifaceted lady. Lena Horne. Concomitant with the publication of her autobiography by Doubleday, she talks for Pacifica listeners from San Francisco's Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill. My name is Gene D'Alessi.
What's your explanation of the phrase nitty-gritty?
I don't know. One thing I think it could mean is truth. One thing it could mean is the sediment that's left after something's been stirred up, and there, the nitty-gritty of it is left. It could be the bare bones of us, skeleton after the bomb, not even a skeleton, that dust or that floating around, that's the nitty-gritty of us.
The nub of the matter, perhaps?
Yes.
That is,
it's a good phrase that covers a lot of territory.
You mentioned a phrase which I'm trying to locate in my notes, which I can't.
Uh-huh.
But it was an equation between how...
Okay, well, we are saved. Lister has shown up and is coming this way now. Ken actually has a slide car key to get in here. That's how he did it. So I'm glad, because I may be a huge Lena Horne fan, but I'm sorry, Mr. DeShazor, I have to say that particular interview just did not sound very good. It's actually gotten very good reviews. It sounds like there's some very interesting stuff going on between that and the whole Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. thing happening there. I have not watched last night's episode because I'm waiting for my partner to come home so she and I will watch it together, because she likes Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has been steadily... started out boring, is getting steadily better and better, although Jim Steranko, as I tried to tell that last caller, but did you notice that neither of those callers wanted to listen to us? No. Did you notice that? Yeah. They just wanted to hear themselves, and especially the first one. You know, it's like, yeah, he's sort of the ghost of Monroe Littman. let's just say that, Steranko, I was mentioning, right. Steranko had an article in the Hollywood Reporter yesterday dissing all of the S.H.I.E.L.D. movies and TV shows, totally dissing it. And he just sounded a wee bit cranky to me, I have to say. I don't know anything about Steranko. I remember his work from Golden Years. One of the very few comic book collections I have include a lot of issues of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., because I collected Doctor Strange.
Right.
I loved Doctor Strange, largely because I listened to Doctor Strange on WBAI, on the radio dramas that David Rapkin and Charles Potter did. And those, especially the episodes with Dormammu and the great sound effects, great special effects they had, better than any of the special effects in current movies. And so I was a big Doctor Strange fan, having listened to the radio episodes on these same airwaves. And as a result of that, I would get bored of reading the same Doctor Strange story for the fifth time that month, and I would read the other stuff in that same magazine, which was either Nick Fury or Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four has its own book. It wasn't in the same book as
No, but there were some Doctor Strange and Fantastic Four crossovers.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the only reason I ever saw any Fantastic Four, and even have a vague idea who Ben Grimm would be, is because I read Doctor Strange, you see. And after that, about the only comic that I actually followed and read on a regular basis was ultimately Howard the Duck. Oh, absolutely. Howard the Duck was brilliant.
That was great comics.
Steve Gerber was thoroughly, totally subversive. And when it got into black and white, the oversized black and white, it went from being subversive to downright, oh, my duck. I mean, really? That thing, by the time that Anita Bryant shows up as the bad guy who wears a smiley face the entire thing.
Gerber was a brilliant writer.
He really was. He was
he
deluded.
Died way, way, way too young.
He did. But he was also a deluded man and in so many ways. I was on the same bulletin board system. I was constantly on one particular bulletin board system, and he would occasionally come on there as well and rant, which is...
When I interviewed him for Nuff Said, we had different things. When you reintroduce the guests during the show.
Right.
And at one point we go, the funniest boy of 1965. And he's like, where did you find that out?
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, you wrote it. And he had forgotten. He put it in a letter page. Of one of the Man Thing comics that he had been voted funniest boy of 1965 in his school.
Yeah, I got printed a long, long letter. I made them change a series. They had a comic book series called Son of Satan.
Right.
And the Son of Satan bore a proper pentagram, a witch's pentagram, not a satanic one. And I wrote a long, long letter to Marvel, which they then published, about how it was the wrong kind of pentagram. And they...
I remember that letter.
Oh, my God.
I remember that letter.
And
I didn't know it was you, because I didn't know you yet.
And in fact, I mention in there that I work at WBAI, and that was published in that letter. As a result of that, and of course I know this through Margot, as a result of that, I think it was like issue 5 or 6 of Son of Satan, they came up with some excuse to make the pentagram a satanic pentagram. And the entire issue was dedicated to correcting that error. Same kind of problem that Joss Whedon had when he introduced when he introduced witchcraft and witches were all evil before he brings in Willow as a Wiccan. Before he makes her a Wiccan.
Yeah, right.
He had evil witches in there, and this was just
Joss. And Buffy the Vampire Slayer to Doctor Strange and Son of Satan.
Yeah, exactly. So, now he's in charge of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
I'm
rather happy about that.
And I'm not.
You're not.
I'm not. Because where is Joss Whedon's original shows? Where's the next Firefly movie? Where's Faith the Vampire Slayer? Where's the
I'll totally accept that as a good reason to be unhappy about it. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he did a wonderful job on the Avengers. It's a funny, intelligent, well done, not overwrought film, and I think only Whedon could have pulled it off as well as he did. Having said that, he's playing in somebody else's sandbox, like his sandbox.
I have to totally agree with that. I mean, I'm a huge Joss Whedon fan for almost everything he's done.
Yeah, exactly. And I even like Dollhouse.
I did too.
Very interesting.
Subversive aspects in Dollhouse. I mean, I'm like, this is a Fox show? I can't believe it.
Well, all Buffy was a Fox show. You have to remember that. It's not a question.
Yeah, Dollhouse had a lot more subversive elements, I think, than.
Well, yeah, and it was almost like the same reason why you get, subversive science fiction in the Soviet Union and Soviet Poland and places that,
right.
Because it sort of like flies over their head that they don't realize.
No, they don't.
Just
they
how
really
subversive
don't.
This material really, really is.
Yeah, Joe Orlando and Mike Friedrich talked about how subversive Plop was. It was a humor comic.
Yeah.
Sort of a poor man's Mad, but there's all kinds of stuff they snuck in there, and they knew damn well they were sneaking in.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is just...
Nobody knew.
But
we knew.
Yeah. And my biggest problem with superhero movies or comic book movies in general, this was certainly true in Man of Steel, certainly true in Christopher Nolan's Batman series, and all the others, down to with the is that they're devoid of humor. And Joss Whedon, at least, in overseeing the Marvel Universe, has brought comedy back in.
Right, without it being camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Tim Burton brought back.